Hola, I'm Elias Torres, co-founder and CTO of Drift. You are listening to the American Dream Podcast. Did you know that Drift is part of just 2% of VC-backed startups led by Latin American founders? Well, I'm on a mission to change that. On this show, you will hear from leaders who have achieved their own version of the American Dream. We'll talk about what the process looked like to get there, the obstacles they faced along the way, and the work we still have to do to build the new face of a diverse corporate America. Bienvenidos a todos to the American Dream Podcast. Today, I'm excited to welcome a special guest on the show. This is a historic episode for this podcast. Someone I've known for a very, very long time before either of us were entrepreneurs. Sami Shalavi is the founder and chief operating officer of Outcomes for Me, an AI-driven patient empowerment platform that helps cancer patients navigate their care and gain access to personalized treatment options. Before Sami started Outcomes for Me, he spent nearly 12 years at Google, where he built out the Google News products to over a billion users with teams of over 150 people. Today, Sami and I are going to talk about Sami's career journey has looked like and where he's headed with Outcomes for Me. Sami, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. Always great to be with you, my friend.
To give the context to everybody, we were very young. Sami and I are about the same age, and we're exactly the same age. And we were like young whippersnappers, 21, 22 years old, working at IBM. And Sami was working with this unreal group of developers and the Lotus organization here in Cambridge. I remember that was like probably 1999, I think it was like. I think I went to Westford. You guys had the Cambridge office. I was a young IBMer, first time, full-time employee. And I loved building things on the Lotus Notes platform. And so get to meet the people that created Lotus Notes. And then in the room, everybody was like, this guy is amazing. And you were building Lotus Quicker at the time. Mm-hmm. I remember that day like if it was yesterday. I remember the room. I think like you were on the floor discussing something with Ned and Miguel, and I'm just like trying to butt myself in. Like, I want to hang out with these guys. That was awesome. And look at what has happened since then. Let's talk about that. So we were at IBM, and you did what? What did some crazy thing you thought of?
So a couple of it before kind of getting what I did, and it's probably, I think, relevant here, is I'm not a U.S. citizen. I actually grew up in the Middle East. Came to Massachusetts, literally two suitcases. My mom put me on a plane and sent me, and I went to MIT. I didn't actually come wanting to do computer science. I actually came wanting to do mechanical engineering because I didn't know what computer science was. I like computers, but I had no idea what a computer scientist is. So kind of fell into that and fell in love with the domain. And this was the early days of the internet. And there's a lot of funny stories of discovering the internet and email and all that. But after graduating, because I was on an F-1 visa, it was very, very important for me to actually find a place that'll sponsor me, which is, I did an internship at Lotus, loved the place. It was a premier software organization. In those days, it was Lotus versus Microsoft. You're like, okay, I wanted to work at a place where you learn how to build professional software at the highest level, which is why I went to Lotus, and I stayed there for 7 years because that's how long it took for me to get my green card. And it was probably a great experience. It was a really, because I knew I wanted to do something entrepreneurial. I think this is like an immigrant thing. You grow up and you're like, okay, let's figure out how to make money. Let's figure out how to impact, have a lot of impact and do things. When you see problems, you're like, okay, how can I turn that into a thing? And that's kind of like the energy I came in with Lotus, with the humbleness of like learning from some world-class engineers. It was also early days of the internet. And the product that was working Quicker, which was also called QuickPlace, was really how do you take Lotus Notes and bring it to the internet in a simple way. And so we were doing things for the very first time in those days, just going a little technical. There were no established software stacks. There were no frameworks. We were kind of inventing things from the ground up. We were still coding the servers in C and C++ and kind of making stuff up as we're growing. And things we talk about as being like, this is how you build world-class web applications weren't a thing. This is even before, this was like the web 1.0 before a lot of kind of, and one of the big things about being at a place like Lotus or IBM, this was a organization that was multidisciplinary. It wasn't just an engineering shop. It was like, I never heard of a product manager. I never heard of a UX designer. I never heard of like how those disciplines, I never heard of the word triage. What's a bug? I mean, like, this is stuff not you learn in college, but it really kind of exposed, it was like a great lesson in how to actually build, not just like you can have good ideas, you can write good code, but like as you start to actually be part of a larger organization, there's all this stuff that happens around it so that it becomes a world-class product.
Yeah. I think that that's, I love that story, right? Because that's why we call this the American dream, right? Because your story is no different than any other immigrant, right? The whole two pieces of luggage is the same thing. I came with my mother. You came by yourself, huh? Straight into school. Wow.
I mean, truth, it was actually, because I'd never been to America. I mean, I was fortunate. I went to British schools in the Middle East, but I understood Middle Eastern culture and British culture. I just didn't understand American culture. And I mean, this is also an era. This is, again, I'm like dating myself, 90s. There was no internet. The way I discovered MIT was there was a TV program that showed a robotics competition. My father was a mechanical engineer, and he said, you should go there. That's where all the smart people go. And that's actually how I discovered MIT. And living through, I was in Kuwait, lived through the Gulf War, then went to Jordan. And my dad passed away. So I was like, it became a mission. So like, okay, how does one apply to MIT? I don't know. So I went to there's a section of the American embassy called the Amidist. I went there. There was a library. I'm like, okay, where's the college book? Okay, where's the college book? Okay, let me put down the name of the universities. I took that down, wrote a letter, put it in the mail. 1 month later, you get this application. And then you kind of like methodically go through it. Okay, they need you to take the SAT. Okay, what's an SAT? How do I do that? Okay, there's actually kind of a funny story. There was a part of that application. And like when you're kind of growing up in a place where there isn't a lot of peer support, you're kind of like, okay, you get this application, you're going to follow it. There isn't going to be a box that is not filled out. It's going to be perfect. There was one box that asked for your name, address, et cetera. And then there was one that called, that was email. I didn't know what email was. And I went to the encyclopedia. The encyclopedias, I guess, were so old. There was no, there was no explanation. So that was actually, that answering that question was a bit stressful for me because I could answer everything else except like email. Are they going to accept deny me because I didn't know my email address?
What a moment. What a moment. You're stuck because the encyclopedia doesn't have it. Nobody else around you has one. And like, who do you call? You you got to go around the streets. Do you have an email? Does anybody have an email here? Anybody
Does anybody
has ever
know
had-
what it is? Is it a thing you buy? Can I go buy one? Can I go rent one? I don't know. Anyways, so eventually, long story, it's like mailed back and forth. And it was actually a really humbling experience because it was not just like I didn't expect it, but I applied and then it came back with an acceptance and a full scholarship. So that was transformative moment. And this is actually where, like for international students, there are very, very few universities that offer scholarships. MIT is one of them. I think some of the Ivy Leagues also do it, which is, I mean, put aside, this is just my opinion now being an American, this is America's secret weapon. They can get like unbelievable talent to come here. And the thing is when you come here, and you build a life. I mean, you end up building a life because you see the opportunities in this country. And anyways, so I got my letter, and then my mom gave me a bunch of money. I had two suitcases, flew to Logan Airport, came out there. I had a piece of paper that said 77 Mass Ave. Okay, that's the address. I get into a cab, take me to 77 Mass Ave in Cambridge. And then you show up and you're like, okay, let me just follow everyone to where they're going. Okay, there's a bunch of people. All right, they're going to the student center. Let me go there and figure it out. Like, hey, and then I had a much heavier British accent at the time. Hello, my name is Sammy. I just arrived. And then it was a very welcome experience. They set me up in a dorm, and 5 years later, ended up the first year transferring from mechanical engineering to CS because I discovered that. And then ended up at Lotus. While I was a student, I was always a hustler. I always had a side hustle.
I just love that this was a mission for you because of the words of your father. That's so special. It is transformative, just the words. This is why we have to always think about the words that we tell others, right? The word that simple could just change your life, right? Out of anything your dad could have ever done, that was probably one of the most important things he did.
Yeah.
You should go there, Sammy.
It was like a comment as part of watching a TV program.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, side story, that competition is called 270 at MIT. The class is called 270. And I went and I watched it in real life.
Wow. And that's what we have to think as parents, right? What we tell our kids.
Yeah.
Simple as that. I told my son, my youngest, he took an aptitude test that I had to take for Vista. And he goes, "What are you doing that? I'm taking this test. Come here. Sit down. Take it." And he takes it. And when he was done taking it, he like beat me by a point without any practice. And I said to him, "You're so smart." It's like, "You know you can do computers." And he goes, "No, Dad, I don't understand him." I go, "You absolutely can." They were like, "What are you talking?" He's taking CS in high school now.
Great. I'm trying to convince my son to do CS. He took a programming class, but it's not sticking the same way when I was messing with computers. But you want them to like have the drive, have the work ethic, and also follow a passion.
And follow a passion, yeah. And he likes art. So what I discovered, he in the CS class, I don't know what, thank God, but he's writing this Python language to render vector graphics. So he has code here and he's rendering this character from anime. And so he's like, "Dad, look." He's like, "I do the shadow, I do this drop shadow, I shift this, I do the opacity." And I'm like, I couldn't draw, right? But he's finding the intersection that he likes. And I'm just like, oh. So I may have three CS kids in my life. I told you about my first one a little bit, but that you had that, right? You did not know your passion, and he told you that. And then tell me more a little bit about that entrepreneur hustle. Like, I had that hustle as a Latino, as an immigrant, of like finding ways to get the job done or doing something, but there's an entrepreneurial one about building a big business or building a business. Did you have that already or was it separate?
True story. When I was in high school, I figured out that I made like a bunch of, I mean, because part of it is like you're trying to solve problems and see what, and part of it's like to get like a little bit of extra spending money. So I had a little program that like I kind of coded / copied, which would basically, if you answer a few questions about your palm and the lines on your palm, it'll actually give you, I found a, like a thing that said, this line means this, this line's mean that. So you answer a bunch of questions. And then I went to my cousin was at the local college and I said, "Hey, why don't we offer like computer generated palm reading?" And it was like, I made like a couple of $100 doing that, which was, I mean, at the like Jordanian money, that's a lot of money.
No, that was some real hustling right there.
Yeah. So just like taking like, okay, it's modern, it's this. And so the concept of like hustling is like, I think my dad also had his own business. So you kind of learned from him that like, okay, this was, things don't just happen. You have to go get them. You have to go. And I used to actually do a lot of, I mean, one of the things he figured out, this is now in the 80s. He figured out if you actually present, because he did a lot of contracting. If you present your reports or your RFPs using computers, not hand-drawn images, people think you're more advanced. So this is like the connection of like, hey, technology can unlock things. So I used to do all these drawings for him using like some CAD program that I had on my PC, and then he would get those projects. So you kind of like, this was, I'm talking about it, it's like subconsciously you realize, hey, technology can give you an edge if you know what you're doing. And it can also create a tremendous amount of efficiency. I mean, even at the time, like word processing, people used to actually type with like a typewriter. And the thing is like, if they had feedback on the RFP, we'd just go edit it and it'll be done. You don't have to edit the whole thing. If you needed to change something in the architectural drawing, it was a small edit, not redraw the whole hand-drawn thing. So it was just you realize this thing, like technology can actually drive tremendous efficiency. And I got experience with my dad, got experience. And then when I went to MIT, I discovered the internet, web pages. So like the thing at the time was all these classes realized they needed to actually have websites to actually describe the curriculum. And that was like an insight I had at MIT. So I used to go to professors and ask them, hey, do you want a website for your thing? And this was at the time, there were no tools. There's nothing like any of the tools today. You're coding
in VI, HTML, right on the, you like the classes were like tilde CS, 50. That's a
So I used to go around and ask the professor, do you want a web page? And the way MIT works is like they actually will cover the cost on the behalf, like the school will pay for it. So I had this whole thing where I was like running around at school trying to get, and then I ended up hitting capacity. So then I taught some other students that I knew like how to do it. And I had like this mini consulting operation going at MIT. And that kind of mindset has just been with me everywhere I have been. Even at Lotus, you're like, okay, what's there interesting to do? But the difference is, I would say, I think that was the transformation. I would say when you were asking, like, okay, from trying to solve problems to like thinking at another scale, this is actually the thing I would say that was part of the MIT experience, and I would say part of the Lotus experience. And then later in my career in the startup, especially at Google, like the scale of thinking and the scale of opportunity is actually something you learn. You realize, I mean, as an individual, as you're growing and building skills, you don't really realize your potential and the potential one can have the impact. And it's definitely been amplified through technology. As a technologist, it's one of the most shocking things. A small number of people can build software that can transform the world. It's kind of nuts. Some of which I've been part of, like a lot of great companies, and I'm sure it was the case at Drift, like it started with the small nucleus, and look at you now, a major player that's transformed how people converse.
That's powerful. I think that that's an interesting inflection connection between two things. One is that little hustle attitude that you and I share as immigrants and growing in places with scarce resources, right, where you had to hustle. I don't know. My stereotype would be that the Middle East is way more hustlers than Latin America. I think we're more social and like we enjoy, but like that notion of like more business selling and stuff, I think there's more experience at that, I feel like, than it is in Latin America.
I mean, one of the things, I mean, this is a true story. When I came to America, it was the first time I met Latin American people. It was the first of like meeting all sorts of people.
Right.
And actually, it's one of those interesting, like a lot of my best friends in college were because there was such overlap in the cultures.
Yeah. No, there is, absolutely. But I'm underselling myself. I feel like that not as many businesses, but the hustler of like when you are scarce resource, that you have to get something and you have to find a way. And so that's like the seed, that raw talent that we have. And I love what you said about the scale, it has to be learned. And what I'm trying to say is I feel like an American entrepreneur that has been born here, they might have more access to learning about the scale first. And so they're trying to build things just because they know the scale potential, right? The mechanics and the levers, right? We have to go stumble our way one step at a time with that hustle and learn the scale until you know what you can achieve, right? What's possible.
Yeah, but I think also that was when we came to America. That was actually very, very true. I mean, I never heard the word entrepreneurship. I didn't know what it is. I mean, now I call myself an entrepreneur, but I was like, I didn't know that was a thing. There were no entrepreneurship classes. The whole concept of, I mean, like everything was so foreign. Now, with the internet, with the access to information, our children are getting more and more exposed to this. And I would argue in those, like there are now more frameworks for actually taking an idea and breaking it down and seeing it. I'm like early days, I'm like I didn't know how to, like I didn't know what a TAM was. or even to think about it. You're kind of like the way you think about creating businesses is it's all about cash flow.
Yeah.
As opposed to what's the upper, it's just a very different way of thinking, and that's what's learned, and it's definitely getting better. But that's I think the opportunity, especially with folks who are new to this, is like, it's a learned skill to think at scale. And I would argue my time around this, the scalable thinking got a few orders of magnitude larger at Google.
Yeah, I mean that is.
I mean, 12 years at Google, you walk in and you're like, okay, you're thinking about products and you're thinking about millions. And then one of the moments for me at Google was when I was working on my very first product there. It was actually a great environment, Dave. There was a lot of flexibility. But like, we got to a million users very, very quickly. And the reaction from folks around me, I'm like, if you're a startup, million, pop the champagne. We're IPOing tomorrow. Let's go. And then at Google, all the response is like, no. That's not like that's nothing. You need to be thinking in the hundreds of millions. And you're like, holy moly. Okay, so how do you think at that scale? And it just starts to change the way you think and the level of ambition. And because it has implications, it's the order of magnitude of thinking, because it starts to change how you triage things and where you spend your energy. And that's actually one of the things I spend a lot of time with my team at Outcomes for me is like, how do we think about scalable thinking? I don't want to add 100 users or a million users or 1,000 users. How do we own the market? And that requires a very different set of tactics than growing 10%, 5%, whatever those percentages, smaller numbers. How do you add a zero? How do you add multiple zeros to the problem? Which is, I think, I mean, it's just, it's, it, it, and that's, and you realize that's also a learned skill.
It's learned. And that's, I think that that's what we want to share with others, right? Is that to not be intimidated or be scared or think that you were not born with it. Because that one is just, it's just a matter of learning, right? It's like, I don't know what a good analogy is, but it's kind of like you're doing some little digging in your backyard with a shovel or with the little hand thing. And somebody that manages a large equipment can dig up way more, but it's just because they just learn how to pull two levers, right? And it's like, but they got trained to do it. But it's not like they were more powerful. They were exposed to it. And so, you've been exposed to Google, and it's one of the largest companies in the world. And like, wow, right? That's going to be, it just pushes the boundary because of the distribution they have, because of the size, because of the magnitude. And most people that just do smaller startups never get to experience and learn those lessons, right? I remember the day when I asked around and I didn't see you anymore at Google. And they were like, yeah, Sammy left. He went to start a startup. And you know, now that I think about it, that was probably, what year was that?
2000, I would say 18 was the time where I was like, okay, let's do the transition.
18?
Oh no, 19. I mean, it was right the year before the pandemic.
No. I'm talking about when you left IBM.
Oh, IBM. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, sorry. I thought you said Google. I left 2005, 2006, something like that. It was after 7 years. It was around 7 years. I had gotten my green card. And the day I got my green card, I was like, I'm out. I'm going. I'm doing my thing. Because it was very important. Like, as an immigrant, getting your status under control is a very high priority. And
it's a high priority.
Once that threat restriction was removed, it's just okay. Now there's an opportunity, and I connected actually with one of my coworkers at Lotus, Mossy Shore, and this was kind of like the beginnings of Web 2.0, and there was an insight there. This was the beginning of cell phones and the beginning of text messaging, and you just saw this explosion of text messaging as a new medium of communication. It's like people stopped calling each other; they're just texting each other constantly, and the realization is like the amount of communication that's happening here, there's opportunity to remove friction, and how can computing completely change that experience such that it becomes more efficient? We started this company called Zinku with the intent of like, how can text messaging communication drive more efficiency. And we kind of invented what looks like Twitter. And what was interesting about that, we even had the 140 character limit, not because we did any market, because it was the SMS limit.
Yeah.
That's where that number came from. And we, people would text in the stuff and we'd store it and you'd share it with your friends and then you'd post your updates. You can go back. And if you're following someone, you see their stuff. And I mean, like, it's very, very similar in the overall dynamics. We even had the equivalent of invites, invite friends to whatever, and it'll send the text messages and it'll send you a report. So it was just kind of like using text messaging as a medium of communication and a medium of like managing your life. And that was kind of like the thesis of the company. We did very well initially. We raised the $1 million at the time, which was a bunch of money. For me, it was like, I mean, these numbers were just like, what do you mean $1 million? That's, am I a millionaire now? I don't know. But it was just kind of like the first exposure to the whole VC world, raising money. I didn't know. I mean, like, I heard
who
of
it. Who invested? Who invested?
At the time, it was Flagship Ventures. Or like it was a dabbling in health, in consumer. This was Web 2.0 at the time. So we raised a bunch of money. We're still operating very lean, very nimble. I mean, we were like four or five people max at the time. And this is, again, the power of technology. You can build a lot of stuff with a small number of people. And we were slowly rolling it out on campuses, et cetera, to kind of tune the product. And this is actually also where you learn distribution is super hard. I think we talked about this. First time founders think about products. Second time founders think about distribution, because you realize it's one of the hardest things. So we're kind of getting some traction. And then in the middle of like, okay, we're about to go raise our second round, Google knocked on our door and said, hey, we're interested in what you're doing. You guys seem to like think about mobile very differently from anyone else we've seen. You guys look like you're building a platform as opposed to just a solution. And back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, it ended up resulting in Google acquiring the company. We were like a small, like we were, I mean, like a few of us just went to Google. It was like two people because they just wanted like the core engine. They didn't want anything else. We were very, very, very lean. So that's kind of like how that transition, but it took a lot of work. And this is also an era where the nature of M&A or acquisitions was very different from the way it is today. Because I've been fortunate to have acquired companies for Google, and the process I went through is very different from the process I went through. I mean, we're a small little company, like a small number of people, but I have never seen due diligences like this. It was a multi-month, we had agreed to terms and it was months and months and months of due diligence. It's definitely
much easier.
Oh, it's much, much, much easier. I mean, the financial system has definitely innovated to accelerate these acquisitions. I mean, the last acquisition I did at Google took a month from start to close. Those are like on the smaller side, not the huge ones. And then our acquisition took 8 months. Which is an eternity in internet time.
Oh my God. 8 months. It's like I would have died.
Yeah. I didn't sleep for 8 months because you're pretty much waiting for the next email for the next due diligence request. I mean, there's a funny story. They don't do this anymore. At some point they asked, because we had a domain, they're like, okay, we need to see the terms of service for the domain. I remember going to, what's it called?
GoDaddy.
It was GoDaddy. But the thing is, the terms of service were so long, I didn't have a laser printer. So I went to like Kinko's, printed it out, put it in a FedEx box and shipped it to them, which was that was like how funny it was back in those days.
But it was you, I think, to me, you believe in IBM and another one, Kevin Gibbs, going to Google, mm-hmm. right? But you, I think, were probably one of the first ones that I knew personally that left to do a startup.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, he's gone. Where did he
go? Yeah, it was an unusual thing at the time. I mean, it was very rare because a lot of tech people, you end up like at the big tech companies and you're like, you never left.
Yeah. They would go to Google. They would go to Microsoft. They would go switch.
Yeah, they'd switch from one big tech company to another. And I think part of it is overall kind of like family status. I think I would argue part of it was also some naivete. I didn't know what I was getting into. I called it naivety of youth. Like, you don't know what you're signing up for. You don't, I mean, like, you just kind of like do the back of the envelope and just like, I'm generally an optimist about life in general. And you're just like, okay, this is going to work. We're going to make it happen. Let's go figure it out. Oh, holy moly, I'm earning half what I used to. Now what? Okay, so can I make that work? I just got married. And you're like, okay. And then, oh, I didn't really have that conversation with my wife properly. And you're like, oh, then we need to adjust. What do you mean? And so it was, there was a lot of discomfort, but I also buried myself in the work to kind of like put that behind us. And you just put your heart and soul into it. And as a result, it like helps you focus on movement forward. And I would say, like, I learned a lot at Lotus. In those 2 years I did the startup, and I don't know if you had a similar, like, I probably learned 10 times more. Like, it was the first time I attended a board meeting. Holy moly, you have to have an opinion when you show up to those things. You have to think about it before you show up. You can't wing those things. So there's a lot of that. And just being around seasoned folks, you realize, okay, there's a lot of growth beyond just writing great code and great products. There's a lot more to the problem of building teams, organizations, and even great products and the like, all these things were new skills.
But it's something to keep encouraging people and inspiring others that, you know, having a company with two or three people, there's absolutely, that could be a very magical place, right? Where everything, all dreams can come true in one way or another, right? Might not be a straight path, but you had that. And look where you end up, right? 12 years at Google, right? Extremely successful, built great products. There's a lot of products that get sunsetted at Google, but you built one of the ones that is still to this day going really strong, right? That's a testament to you, I would assume, to what you did at that level of scale. But I was going to give you a hard time and say, like, yeah, Sammy, just stay there. You know, like IBM, right? You did IBM 7 and then 12 there, two big companies. And I'm kind of happy that I did 10 years at IBM and I've done like 15 in the entrepreneurial world, right? And I don't think I'm ever going back, right? It's like, I like this world of building and creating. And I'm so impressed, right, by you that you had that short stint, you know, with Cinco. And now you're like back at it again. So tell me, like, what that must have been a huge decision.
Yeah. So there's several sides to it. The entrepreneurial hustle, those 2 years at Google, actually was what made me, I think, very successful there. Because I just thought very differently from. It was just like the hustle of that, and the what it does is it makes you much more well-rounded. And like, just kind of like just building on one of the things you said, like from 2 years of doing your own thing will make you a better person wherever you are. Big company, small company, next startup, new startup, whatever it is, because you learn so much from those, because there's the problems you will see and solve are much more real. And the difference is there's very little like, hey, boss, fix, make it go away. You're the boss. So you end up having to really solve some problems you normally you wouldn't have to. So at Google, one of the things you learn scale, you learn that you can actually build products that can kind of fundamentally impact the world. In the case, like I did, was leading the reimagination of Google News around which was triggered by what was happening in the United States around the presidential election between Hillary and Trump. And the news industry's relationship with Google got really sour. It's like, you're proliferating fake news, reinforcing filter bubbles, destroying our business model. What are we going to do about that? Which actually triggered kind of the formation of a group that I ultimately ended up taking over, which was like reimagining what news is like. And the ambition there was like, we are going to actually solve a much larger problem, a societal problem. we're helping people get involved, and it really kind of like, and you learn the discipline of how, well, like, what does that mean? What does news mean for people? And after doing that, you kind of like, you see the success. When I took over Google News, it was a big product. And then in the 1 year after its launch, we more than doubled, added another 1 billion users to the product, which is kind of crazy. But, and that just didn't happen organically. This is actually where, like, I learned a lot about a brand will get you a certain number. You actually have to think about distribution in order to reach that scale. And there was like all sorts of work we did about partnering with folks, viral flows in the product, because it just doesn't happen. This whole organic thing, yes, it does happen, but it's so hard and it's so rare. You have to be very, very
sure. Part of it has to be design, and I think you're right. I mean, the lower bar, the entry bar for Google might be higher than most every other company, and you get that for free. But anything else after that, you have to earn it. You have to design. You have to iterate on it and think and innovate. If not, it's not going to be for free. Yeah, I mean, which is why a lot of Google products fail, right? People think just because they're Google doesn't mean you have guarantees.
Yeah, I mean, so this is, I learned this. If you have a thing with a Google name, you're going to get 1 million users. It's hard to get more than that. You actually have to be intentional. You have to think about distribution. This was like our relationship with Google Play, which was basically built on the relationship with Android. Android was exploding primarily its relationship with the phone manufacturers. Those kind of relationships are the things that drive incredible growth. And if you a lot of highly distributed products kind of did that by doing the very clever partnerships and very clever product flows to kind of get them at that level. But coming back to your original question, which was what happened. So you work on these societal problems. A couple of things happened. A bunch of family members got diagnosed with cancer. And being in Boston, which is kind of the mecca of healthcare, everyone's calling. Hey, do you know an oncologist? Do you know an oncologist? Is my doctor, is it right? Is what I'm getting wrong? Is it this? Is it that? And because I'm fortunate, I have a network, et cetera, I'm able to kind of help answer these questions. And the thing that kind of blew my mind is the more you dig into this problem, there's a tremendous amount of friction. The information on the internet is so confusing. It is incredibly confusing. I mean, like, you ask any physician, they hate Dr. Google because most people's diagnoses are highly nuanced to their actual treatment is a function of their diagnosis and the test results. And it's especially the case in cancer. And to take it one step further, I actually didn't know this. Cancer treatment in the United States is defined by a whole series of nationally defined clinical guidelines by this organization called the NCCN, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. In Boston and in the top cancer centers, the top oncologists sit on the committees that define the national guidelines. And if you look at them as a computer scientist, you'll notice they look like a decision tree. You do a whole bunch of tests and then you go, okay, HER2 positive, okay, this is your treatment. Okay, this is your treatment plus this if this test is true. And you look at them like, okay, why isn't this an algorithm?
And it's not that big. I'm assuming it's still, and it's quite not that large of a decision tree.
No, it's a pretty significant decision tree. It's pretty significant. It's hundreds and hundreds of pages per cancer.
Props to them that they have developed that, right? I mean,
it's very, very impressive work. That's, I think, the first part. The second part that I found in particular interesting is, and this is like it shows the actual scope of the problem. The guidelines change every 3 months. And you may have heard the term precision medicine. And I didn't know what that meant. I just like, okay, precision, like it's more precise. But actually, the more you dig into it, and it's very, very relevant in oncology, is in precision medicine, what all the science and all the focus is essentially they look at your genetics, what you're born with, genomics, which is basically the biomarkers and characteristics of the tumor. And those become new inputs into deciding what your treatment is. And almost all the new drugs are pretty much looking at genetics and genomics as a means to decide what treatment you're on. They're moving at a rate of they're changing every 3 months because there's a the science is moving very, very quickly. There's a lot of research in cancer. And then you kind of like, well, if you take a general oncologist, and this is a study that I quote a lot, is for a general oncologist to be up to date with the latest science, they need to be reading 27 hours a working day.
So not going to happen.
Which is impossible. So there's a real problem there. In Boston, because you see specialists of specialists, you're almost certainly always getting the latest cancer treatments.
The latest is still like 9 months behind or whatever.
Yeah. So in Boston, it's like in the top hospitals, it's usually the case. But when you start to go into community settings outside of the academic centers, a lot of the times you may not be getting the latest treatment. That's the first part. For the other thing that was, I think, also surprising to me is for advanced cancers, like metastatic stage 4, it's a pretty grim diagnosis. The best options are clinical trials. And if you want to see another shit show, this is like, there are a few thousand clinical trials. You go to the state of the art, which is this thing called clinical trials, which is a government website, try to decipher anything. And you're like, why isn't technology? Like, I spent my career pretty much trying to match. I mean, like Google News, we were seeing 64,000 new articles a minute. And we're able to get them in front of users based on their interests within like seconds of us seeing that stuff. Like, this is a solvable CS problem. And if you kind of put that together.
Yeah. Which is like, it's solvable because it's not like you're figuring out the science. You're just leveraging the science of the few of the best and making it accessible to everybody in real time, right? So they don't have to digest all these papers and this stuff. And you're saying like, you're going to get the latest information.
That's exactly. And this is actually like the catalyst. Like, you get all these family members, they're asking you for help. You're trying to untangle this. You're talking to the science and you realize there's actually a lot of opportunity for technology to completely transform the experience at scale. Again, going back at scale. And in the process, connected with an MIT classmate of mine who is from the pharma world, the big question is like, okay, you've got a problem. Is this something that can, is this a business? Or is this just a solution? Or is this just a feature? And after kind of spending a lot of time, there is a business, which is about helping people get on clinical trials, getting more awareness around the latest treatments. And if you approach it from a, let's build a product that solves people's cancer journey, not what's their treatment, no, their entire holistic journey. And you kind of enhance it with sponsored experiences that are about helping improve their journey, you can actually make both sides work. And that was kind of like the catalyst. So I started off as an advisor with the company with around this problem, and then you see the friction, you see the opportunity, and you're like, okay, this is like, we can actually do something transformative here that is not about just building an oncology solution. We can actually fundamentally change people's outcomes at scale, primarily by empowering people to have the information. Like, when people ask, what do we do at Outcomes for Me? The thing that commonly comes back, you're going to tell me if I go to the Mayo Clinic, what they're going to tell me without me having to travel by just answering a few questions? And the answer is yes, because they're going to tell you what's based on these national guidelines, what's in the guidelines. And then when you approach the problem as a technologist who enjoys building consumer experiences, it's not about just features. You need to think about the entire journey. And this is the thing, and like, when you think about it, the journey, now you need to start adding all these other things, because now you're creating an engaged product that people use, that actually is providing value, that's providing support, that's actually helping with their emotions, that's dealing with mental health, that's dealing with compliance with meta. And then suddenly all this stuff comes together. It's like, oh, this is like a pretty big idea with a pretty big solution. Well, that was kind of like the transformation where it was initially catalyzed by what was happening in my life. You see a problem, and the latter half is like, well, if that is the problem, is there an opportunity to solve this at scale? This is, again, like the thing I learned. Like, you need to think about that order of magnitude. When you think about it that way, then it becomes like a pretty big opportunity that you also feel great about too.
Wow. Yeah, no, this is fantastic. Makes a lot of sense, and it is super inspiring, right? To be able to recap that journey from you should go to that school, you should go to that competition, to show up knowing nothing, to doing whatever it takes, not complaining. You went to IBM, you kind of triaged that and you said, okay, I'm going to go work there because I need my visa. I need my green card, right? Then you become an entrepreneur, learn to do the work, and then you get exposed to scale, right? I mean, we had some scale at IBM, but you made an impact, right? Because we're still dealing with this problem with the news, right? News is a complete disaster. But you got to play it and try to solve it at the highest levels. And then you just run into this, you know, unfortunate events, that series of events, but your mind is now thinking at scale. And now you're like, how do I solve this for the whole world? Like, I mean, it's like, if the best person, if the best doctor is just going to triage something in a decision tree that is outdated, at least I'm going to do that automatically and make the same decision for you in real time, right? And you can change the lives. I mean, we're curing cancer little by little, right, with advances. But this is the dream of AI, right, to be able to say, like, everybody gets the same treatment. You could be in the jungle in Nicaragua, and you can, through a phone and through a text message.
Right. I mean, one of the saddest things about the actual, like, when a drug gets approved, it takes years for it to actually make it to the health throughout, like, to actually get disseminated. It starts with the top cancer centers, but it takes a long time for it to get prescribed. And that's actually, I think, our big opportunity is to help people get on these new innovations. In the case of clinical trials, get them onto trials earlier because they're so hard to untangle and figure out. And that's the kind of stuff that actually changes people's outcomes. And the difference is like thinking about it scale, but the solution we're building is like helping one life at a time.
But you can build infinitely. You can build.
It's been like a great couple of years because 1 in 4 breast cancer patients are on the platform. We know this, which is great, great impact. We know, we don't measure it, but we know anecdotally that people are actually using our app to get on trials and argue with their doctors. Like, no, the app told me I can get on. The doctor says no. And then they've emailed us, like, your app actually got me on a clinical trial that's actually going to fundamentally.
Because how is the doctor has no time to, like, breathe or eat lunch.
Yes.
Right?
And then if you actually look at the health, like the challenges in the healthcare system, the actual time doctors spend with patients is shrinking because the system's trying to make it much more efficient because their time is expensive. And cancer treatment is like psychologically, it's like a big, it's like very, very, very challenging. And most patients want infinite time with their doctor to answer all their questions, let alone the emotions, et cetera. And if technology can help make that time more efficient and more pointed, that's empowerment. And that's kind of like
just to get to answers, just to get to like at least spread it, go to this clinical trial that they're waiting for people, right? And so if you can qualify them for them, it's like just an amazing, it solves the problem on both sides, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things actually we spend a lot of time with patient education, half the time it's like, I don't even know what questions to ask. Why is that relevant? And so we've been spending a fair bit of energy just like helping with the treatment. The other interesting thing where, I mean, we're going to spend some time on solving that is after cancer treatment, people's care transitions from the oncologist to the primary care. And typically a lot of the drugs people take to kind of deal with the cancer are actually like can have a lot of secondary effects that need to be monitored. I mean, some of the drugs can compromise the heart. And that's also where things tend to fall through the cracks because the primary care isn't equipped. So we spend actually a whole bunch of, and kind of our general approach, and this is again, just kind of a philosophy of when you're building world-class products, first, I mean, like you need engineering, you need product, you need design. But I think one of the critical things is you need domain experts in the space to help guide what you're building. When you kind of combine all these things, that's when the magic happens. And so we have physicians, nurse practitioners on staff, and we partner with top cancer centers. So for example, we're thinking about, we've been building our survivorship module, which is what happens after cancer treatment, with Vanderbilt Cancer Center with Dr. Deb Friedman, who is on the committee that's writing the national guidelines for survivorship for cancer, to kind of transform those guidelines into technology. This is, again, like the, so a lot of good things happen in healthcare. They get into guidelines, but then the transition from guidelines to technology is, I think, where the opportunity is and where the friction is. And sometimes people don't even realize technology can play a role because they've been working in a certain way.
And I love the connection, the arc, right, from you editing CAD design, and the basic innovation was really just the editability of this thing and not have to reprint it, not redraw it, right? Which I experienced the same typing my stuff with my first computer. And you think that would have been gone by now, that ability to that efficiency. And here you are effectively saving
the time of a
human being just going through a decision tree and getting a copy of a decision tree. And you're like digitizing it, right? To be able to navigate a complex tree so it more accurately takes the person to the spot. So we have the answer in front of us, but we don't know how to distribute it and how to monitor it and how to coach it and how to scale the delivery of it.
Yes, right? Scale the delivery. I mean, just to go back, those decision trees are actually clinician facing. They're not patient facing because they're just incomprehensible.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like,
I think a big part of innovation is taking that and turning it into like consumer friendly language that they can understand.
But it is impressive, right? That we have, like, sometimes medicine blows us away how simple it is, right? But it's impressive that they have created such a thing that has highly effective rates, or effective rates better than just having a customized doctor just for you, right? They're not going to figure it out on their own. They're putting together everybody's research into one place.
Which is amazing.
Amazing. And so love that. And I love, like I said, that you continue to pursue the dream. And you got off your ass at Google. You could have been staying there being busy. And it's an encouragement to people, right, to think about opportunities and things that they run into their real life. And chase, go after them, you know, and not, because you could have delegated this problem to somebody else. But you took it on. And that's such powerful and speaks so highly of you, of what you're willing to do. And it's what a pleasure and privilege of knowing you and seeing a little bit of the arc of your life, getting to know a little bit of the earlier part of it, and continue to know you and see how you're going to change the world. So we still have 10, 20, maybe 40 years left. You're kicking my ass to do more.
Yeah. If you have an idea, you see a friction point in the world, there's always, if you've got the time and the drive,
the health,
there's a lot of problems. I mean, this is actually one of, for me, the most challenging things about the problem in healthcare is because I don't come from healthcare. Everywhere you look, there are problems. There's a problem. I wouldn't say problems, like it's like problems that technology can remove friction. And that's actually one of the biggest challenges. When I talk to the team, it's like everywhere you look, it's very, very easy to get lost in all the problems of healthcare. And it's really trying to find that like path in the forest to kind of have impact. Again, good scalable thinking. You need to kind of, like you can tube on the wrong things.
We are so scared of, with our kids and stuff like that. I always think as a parent, right, of removing friction from them, but friction is never going away. I mean, the goal of human beings is to remove friction because it just creates itself and creeps upon us. But if you don't learn to deal with friction, how are you going to ever be successful, right?
Yes. And it's not just deal with friction. It's also being able to identify it.
To feel it. Like sometimes people are numb to it, right? And they're okay. But that immigrant thing is, I think that's what we're susceptible. Part of the hustle is the ability to detect the friction, right? And be able to say, why am I, you know, it's like, this is not working, right? It's like, so where, it's kind of like they say salespeople, they're like water coming down the roof. Water finds the path of least resistance, right? Always going down. And so like, that's what a hustle is, right? It's like when you're like moving like water, because you're like, I want to avoid it.
and I think the other half of it is that, especially if you've come from if you've been in a developing country, the level of friction is just like another level. Like this, I mean, first thing, actually, this was the experience for me. I mean, getting a passport in the United States was like, for me, an eye-opening experience. I mean, getting a passport in another country has been, is like a, I mean, like it's easier to go to the doctor, get a colonoscopy and come back than sometimes to get your first passport.
Yeah. I mean, I was, when I got married, I was going to Ecuador with my wife, and that was 20 years ago. And they changed the law that I'm from Nicaragua. I didn't need a visa at that time when I checked, but when I got married, they changed it that I needed. So they did not let me get on the plane. And so and I just went around driving around Miami, and in about less than 24 hours, I had gotten my visa.
Yeah.
Because I'm an immigrant hustler, right? But I literally went to places. I don't have a network, but yet we found the consulate in some building of Ecuador, and then who was there. It's funny because this guy came before me and they said, the bell says, do not ring the bell more than three times or something like that. And the guy goes, ding, 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 ding. And so the person comes out and says, and he goes, I need my visa, stamp it. And the woman goes, no, we can't do that today. Come back tomorrow. Because the guy violated the rules. He said, like, when I saw that, when I like waited there, and then I brought the pictures for my wedding, and they knew my wife. And so like, and like, I'm in the back of the embassy. it's like, that's how you get stuff done. But it's like, I went from like no visa and I, no car, no Uber, no phones. This is 1998, you know? And I was like, find my way to get to the country. Right. And when we were getting out, same thing, her ID had expired from Ecuador. Mm-hmm. And then we had to leave the airport while we were past customs, go out to some ministry thing, and we had to get it done. And I had to do some illegal stuff to like get it done and come back to the plane so we make our flight. But it's mind blowing.
Yeah.
Right now, I took a picture at CVS, send it to the post office, and they just mailed me my passport.
Yes. Yeah. It's. I mean, it's just, it was such a transform. And then you realize, okay. So because we've seen the stuff, like, oh, and you've seen the extremes. So whenever you see extreme stuff, you're like, it can be efficient.
Yeah.
And then once you learn technology, you're like, oh, we can use tech to remove all these friction points.
That's awesome. Awesome. Great stories. I feel like we're going to have to do more stories. Thank you so much for being on the episode, historic episode. I hope everybody understands. Like, I don't know. I hope they get a glimpse of how impressive of an impact you made on the world, right? And that you continue to do.
Oh, appreciate it.
From a kid that didn't even have an email address.
Yeah. I didn't know what it was.
Really great stories. Thank you so much, Sammy.
Thank you for having me. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for listening to the American Dream Podcast. Make sure to hit subscribe so you never miss when a new episode drops. If you like this episode, please leave a 6-star review wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you're interested in learning more about my American Dream mission, subscribe to my newsletter linked in the show notes.